30th of November 2012, and you're listening to The Pod Delusion, a podcast with no statutory underpinning. I'm James O'Malley. Coming up this week, we answer the questions. Who won gold at the Science Blogging Awards? And who got stuck with boron? If zombies invade the LHC, should you aim for the Higgs? Why on earth did the BBC axe the naked scientists? And how are Argos using nanotechnology? But first, if you enjoy The Pod Delusion and would like to support what we do, then please do subscribe and donate £5 or £10 a month. Our hosting costs have doubled over the past couple of months, so all donations are hugely appreciated. You can find links to donate at poddelusion.co.uk. Now let's get on with the show, and we start the programme this week with a couple of award ceremonies that took place in London this week. Last Monday was the Royal Society's Science Book Prize, but the night before was something a bit more modern. Last Sunday night, the Good Thinking Society gave out their Science Blogging Prize, which they created because, let's face it, blogs can spread information to many more people than relatively obscure science books can. And I recently learnt that it turns out in a book, you can't even comment at the end and send the author abuse, which is a real shame because I'd just finished reading Pippa Middleton's book. No one can tell me how to run an egg and spoon race, Pippa! Anyway, the event was co-hosted by Soho Skeptics, of which the Pod Delusion is a part, so we recorded the event and have some highlights. Here we go.
The best part of the blogging prize, I felt, was the sheer delightfulness of all the bloggers who got to say a few words in front of the assembled science geeks. Hopefully, we've captured in this highlight reel some of the engaging nature of these very interesting people. First up, Simon Singh and Ben Goldacre explain why the blogging awards were set up and why they think it's important to recognise their work.
But just to tell you about how all this came to be, less than 3 months ago, I was chatting to Ben Goldacre, and he pointed out that we have prizes for science journalism in general, we have prizes for books in science, but we don't have any recognition for bloggers. And we set up Good Thinking Society earlier this year to try and take on these kind of issues. So if there's a gap, we'll try and fill it, and this seemed to be a real gap. And we looked up at what was happening, and it turned out the Royal Society Book Prize is happening tomorrow. And so we set ourselves a deadline. Could we set up a blog prize that took place before the big book prize tomorrow? Because, again, another point Ben made was that some of the blogs that are published on Science Today have a bigger readership than the entire shortlist of the book prize. And that deserves to be recognised. We'll try it and do it again next year. My real hope is that somebody else will probably take this on. Perhaps the Royal Society, along with their book prize, will acknowledge the huge range and diversity of all of this wonderful blogging that goes on. Maybe the ABSW will take this on board, and it'll happen with them next year. But if nobody else does take it on board, then Good Thinking Society will be here again, and we look forward to doing this again next year. Thanks a lot.
For the most part, it's science blogs that I read when I want to read about nerdy stuff. And that's because you are kind of unedited. And I mean that in a good way and a bad way. I don't really care about the quality of writing, although there have been occasions when we've been marking these that I've wanted to wrestle some of you to the ground. But more because you're unashamed to put in proper nerdy details. You don't say studies today said. You don't recycle a press release. You don't run an article about how Susan Greenfield thinks that we're all going to die if we use the internet. You are, to my mind, you know, the royal institution of today. A couple of hundred years ago, seriously, a couple of hundred years ago, a few nerds set up this organisation to publish their findings, to argue about science in public, and to hold open events. And today, the Royal Institution has a closed journal. You can't get the archives without paying. It's an organisation that's situated in Mayfair, a part of London that I literally never go to, with events that are so expensive that by the time you've bought a ticket, you certainly couldn't afford to spend £7 on a pint in the bar. And I think having events like this in a straightforward pub, having blogs that are free to access, is the most important and powerful thing that we could do to keep real, proper, nerdy science alive today. I'm going to go and find the people who I vaguely recognise from their Twitter avatars, because this is a room full of people who all have like highly contextual micro fame. And that is the fame of, you know, Andy Warhol said we're all famous for 40 minutes or whatever. I think today we're all famous for 40 people. So, this is, I hope, like Simon says, the beginning of something bigger and better than just this room. There are a lot of science bloggers who are derided by their head of department, And it's a real shame to me that people who work and produce such fantastic content for no money at all don't get institutional support.
One of the first to speak was Andre Tomlin from the Mental Elf blog.
It's a pleasure to be here. I feel a little bit like a nerd. I'm an information scientist rather than a proper scientist. But I kind of have been blogging for 18 months. So I'm a young, naive person in this crowd, I think. It's a real honour to have been nominated. Just to finally tell you, the Mental Elf is one website. We have seven elves now in the National Elf Service. So there's 20 people that have gotten involved with me. So we have a dental elf, a learning disabilities elf, a diabetes elf, a musculoskeletal elf. We've got a education elf. And we're also thinking about launching a commissioning elf and a women's elf soon. And the idea behind the elves is that they're, you know, these little characters who just don't sleep. Essentially, they're keeping you up to date. And they're doing it in a way which hopefully is a bit more approachable than most health information websites aimed at health professionals.
One of the winners, Susie Gage, from the Sifting the Evidence blog, spoke about how her blog kept her from being a social recluse and also five reasons why PhDs should blog.
Just like to say thank you so, so much for shortlisting me. It's an absolute honour. Like Andre, I haven't been blogging for very long, maybe, yeah, about 18 months as well. I feel very much like a newbie blogger still, so it's really amazing to be here. But I'll just finish off with five reasons why it's good for PhD students to blog. Okay, so number one, it's a two-way conversation, which when you're dealing with ones and zeros all the time is very good. But also it means you get to really think about what you're writing and people comment on it. You get immediate feedback and it's really, really positive. I definitely feel like my writing has improved leaps and bounds since I started. Number two, you're the boss, which doesn't happen much as a PhD student. So you can write about whatever you want, when you want, how you want. You don't have to follow any editorial guidelines. But that doesn't mean that that there's no one there to help you. So I found really supportive colleagues who will happily read over posts that I write. Okay, number three, the immediacy. You can comment on things that happen almost instantaneously. So the most popular blog I've ever wrote was a critique of the Cannabis and IQ paper that came out earlier this year. And that had just, because people, when they read something in the newspaper, they quite often want a bit more information than they get from that. So they seek out blogs and you can really have your finger on the pulse, which is really great. All right, I think number four, I think that's where I am. Controversy, which is a good one. You can write what you want and you can stir it up a bit. Although I have since discovered that the pro-tobacco lobby are really good at monitoring you. Whoops. And finally, number five, it's a niche. A niche blog will find its niche audience eventually. Whatever you write, if you write it well, there's going to be someone somewhere on the internet who will be interested in reading it. That said, though, it can take a while to find them. So don't be too disheartened early on if you start and you just can't find those specific people that you're after.
Now here's one of the runners-up, Dorothy Bishop from the Bishop blog.
I wasn't even sure if I'd be eligible for this competition because my blog is a bit of a strange miscellany of anything that captures my interest, which is sometimes science, but it's sometimes other things. And in fact, the way it started was not really with science at all. It started with Twitter. I got onto Twitter. I thought, oh, this is fun. This is good. But I'm so opinionated, I couldn't possibly say what I wanted to say in 140 characters. So I had to start a blog. And as the introduction said, I work in an area where it's really shocking just how much bad stuff there is. So I work with conditions such as autism and dyslexia and so on, and you only have to Google those conditions and you get this mass of stuff. I mean, it's probably similar to cancer and other things, but it's really, you get these desperate parents who want to do something for their kids, and there's all these people out there preying on them, sometimes well-intentioned, sometimes just making money. And there's really not enough good stuff out there telling them about science. Now, I gave as a title Blogging for Wrinklies because I think there's huge advantages for the older blogger. And I was really pleased that this shortlist has got me, Athene Donald, and David. And I thought that's quite, it's okay, we've got women. That's good. But we've also got oldies. And the only real disappointment at this shortlist is Neurosceptic. I'm sorry, Neurosceptic, but there was this Twitter thing last week saying Neurosceptic was Susan Greenfield. You know, we could have had another older woman. Instead, we've got this youthful man. Anyway, but really, I mean, I just wanted to say, blogging is real fun. It's more generally a source of great feedback. And I found it's opened up a huge world to me of enormous pleasure, and I would recommend it to anybody, old or young. I thought Susie Gage was great in telling us what was good about it for the young, but I just want to put the other end there and say it's also good for the old. Thanks very much.
Podillusion regular Dean Burnett was also shortlisted for the blogging prize, and he told a story of how he may not have been the safest bet to even become a scientist.
So I thought I'd tell you why I ended up thinking that, or trying to do comedy via science, because my life in science has been largely a farce, start to finish. Well, finish, I'm not dead yet, but give it time, I can't see it changing soon. For starters, I do talk like this, which isn't a good asset for a scientist at all. It's actually... I've managed to smooth the edges off my strong Welsh accent over time, but it has been quite... I mean, for a while, I told people I was a neuroscientist, and they look at me like you look at an orangutan with a digital watch on. And it's like, oh, that's very cute. How do you get that? It's not obviously his. He doesn't know what's going on. But I'm not actually... I do personally think that given my circumstances, I'm not really meant to be a scientist in the universal sense. I'm like an anomaly, an outlier in like what makes typical science. I am the first member of my family to do GCSEs. What my father keeps telling me, I'm the first one to spell GCSEs, which I assume he's joking, but he looks at me deathly serious when he says it, so it might actually be the case. And I don't know why I ended up being a scientist. I just I always remember an event from my childhood when I said to my mother, like I went to my mother in the kitchen, I said, Mom, which I called her, still do actually, she's still alive, she's fine. I said to her, Mom, can I go play down by the river? And she said, no, you can't. I said, why not? Because it's too dangerous. I said, but everyone else does. And she said, if everyone else went off a cliff, would you do that as well? I thought, that depends on many variables, Mother. If I'm on a cliff with all my friends and they all suddenly decide to jump off a cliff en masse, that'd be a first for them. That's not something they do normally. No one has a habit of jumping off cliffs. It's not something you can really have a habit of doing. It's quite fatal. But if they did that all at one time, I would assume the context has changed to make that a preferable option to not jumping off the cliff. Something obviously has changed. Maybe it's a forest fire heading this way. Maybe a rabid bear. Maybe a pack of rabid bears. Either way, something has obviously changed to make jumping off a cliff more preferable an option than not jumping off a cliff, according to this group of people I have with me. Unless, of course, in this context, all my friends are lemons. In which case, they might jump off en masse. Lemons do that. I don't know why. Maybe they do. But no one really knows why. But no, in this scenario, all my good friends are small rodents, suicidal ones at that. So obviously, I'm not very mental compass myself. So maybe I would jump off just because I don't know any better. I'm clearly not really with it. And of course, and people are thinking, oh, I think you'll find that lemons don't jump off cliffs. That's an urban myth. It's not a myth. They don't live in cities. It's a rural myth, if that. But at the time... At the time, I was 10 years old. This is before Wikipedia, before Snopes. I didn't know any better. I was very ill-informed. I live in a small Welsh valley. We had BBC Two in 1987.
Finally, at the end of the night, Simon and Ben presented the first science blogging prizes.
It was really, really difficult for two reasons, picking a winner. One was the sheer quality. There were many bloggers who could have been on the shortlist and who didn't quite make it. And I know some of them are here this evening. Great quality, and I think one of the joys of being a judge, and many people said this, was that they got to read stuff they otherwise were completely unaware of. So that was the first thing that made it difficult. Second reason it was difficult was the diversity of topic. We've had astronomy, we've had neuroscience, we've had all sorts of stuff. We've had student bloggers, we've had emeritus professors bloggers, we've had all sorts of things being written on all sorts of topics, and it's impossible to think about how you pick a winner from that vast range of material. So when we had our meeting, we decided to split the prize. So there are actually going to be two winners, but it's my privilege and genuine honour to be able to announce that the first winner is somebody who has not only has impeccable academic credentials, but is also an incredibly tenacious journalist. The material he puts out for year after year after year has been an inspiration, whether it's Quackademia, whether it's Quacks on the High Street, or whether it's all sorts of issues. Genuine pleasure to announce that the first of our winners is Professor David Cahoon.
Well, as Simon said, there was huge diversity in the blogs that entered. And there was a very small sense of we also felt a need to keep this the whole project alive, and that obviously needs people who are young and vibrant, but also I feel like it's not that you're old and lacking vibrancy, it's just a So we thought it was important that we had that we also reflected the contribution of the young to this evening's prize, and so sorry, that's not as funny as I thought it was going to be. So the second winner tonight is somebody who is unambiguously, straightforwardly, uncompromisingly nerdy in their description of their favourite paper this week, of what they're working on. Really good, honest, straightforward science blog nerdery, as it should be. Susie Gage.
To find out more about the shortlisted and winning blogs, follow the link to the Good Thinking Society from the Pod Delusion website. This has been Liz Lustendorf for the Pod Delusion.
So as I said, on Monday night it was the Royal Society's turn, and their do was a bit fancier than the Good Thinking Society. There were lots of people in suits, people serving food on trays, and a room full of eminent scientists. I even had a chance in the cloakroom to chat to the inventor of the wind-up radio, Trevor Bayliss, about the weather, which was exciting. I didn't tell him though, I loved him on The Big Breakfast. Anyway, whilst we didn't get to speak to the winner, we did get to speak to a rather interesting member of the judging panel. With more, here's Liz.
Last Monday saw the annual Winton Prize, the Royal Society's book prize for the best science writing. This shortlist included books on memory, pandemics, genetics, the history of violence, and parallel universes. But the book that took the prize was The Information by James Glick. The judges said, The Information is an audacious book and offers remarkable insight. Glick takes us with verve and viz on a journey from African drums to computers, liberally sprinkling delightful factoids along the way. This is a book we need to give us fresh perspective on how we communicate and how that shapes our world. Those judges this year were Professor Jocelyn Bell Burnell, who we interviewed for episode 135, Tanya Hirschman, writer-in-residence at the University of Bristol and founder and editor of The Short Review, Kim Shillinglaw, BBC Commissioning Editor for Science and Natural History, Dr. Samuel Turvey, a Royal Society University Research Fellow, and Jasper Ford, author of the Thursday Next series and Shades of Grey. Not to be confused with 50 Shades of Grey, this was a much better book. We had a quick chat with Jasper Ford about how you whittle down 106 books to just one to win the prize. So we're here with Jasper Ford at the Royal Society Winton Prize for Science Books, and you are one of the judges.
Yeah.
How is that? What do you have to do as a judge?
Turning up is the sort of first thing you have to do. No, it's it's delightful to be invited. It's one of those very unusual things, you know, that you get an email from the Royal Society and you go, good Lord, you know, I'm sure that's gone to the wrong person. And then you realise that, you know, they want to get a lot of different views. They don't want to just have scientists on the panel. They want someone like me who likes sort of, you know, writes a little bit sciencey, you know, mangles, you know, physics and science and maths in the way I do, but I'm not actually a scientist. So it was actually really nice to be on the panel to do this kind of thing. But it was quite tricky. We had a lot of books, and you have to, some of them you can sort of look at and then sort of chuck out the window straight away. But we chatted about it beforehand, about what the criteria was, really, before we started looking at them. And it was basically new, exciting ideas. We wanted to read stuff that, when we looked at it, you know, reading this stuff, we were going, wow, yeah, that's amazing. I've never thought of that before, and that is very exciting, and it's very now, and it's very new. So once we have that sort of criteria, then we could, you know, we could bring the list down quite a bit. Getting it down to the long list of 12 was relatively, I won't say easy, but shall we say painless. Painless. But getting it from 12 to 6 was quite hard. Going from 6 to 1 was almost impossible. We loved them all. I mean, we really did. And I'm sure you were recording some of the talks that the authors were giving. And it was just very exciting, actually, to hear their own voices. And what was strange is how much, and I hadn't realised this before, is just how personal science writing can be. You know, because I always thought that fantasy writing, you know, or non-fiction was much more personal. But listening to these guys, you realise that, in fact, you know, that science is very personal as well. So it was wonderful to be here and wonderful to listen to.
We were here at the Book Prize last year as well, and I remember one of the judges saying it's really amazing to agree, and then you get, like Jocelyn Bell Brunel said, a ton of books to read. Is that slightly daunting with that?
It's very daunting, actually, because it literally is a ton of books, and you can't read them all, obviously. But yeah, once you start winnowing them down, and it's great to have all these books, of course, and now. You know, we've got a tremendous cheap way to do Christmas presents. You know, I bought this especially for you. He lied, handing over, you know, a book that I got for free. But I've actually, a couple of the books that we've got, I've kept my copies, but a couple of them we've actually bought extra copies, or I've liberated a few copies from the Royal Society at other meetings to actually give out to friends and relatives, because they were just such great books.
What are the breadth of things that you've seen? Like, we saw the winners or the shortlisters who were, like, pandemics and kind of the information age, I guess, and standard physics, well, not unstandard physics, I guess it was. What other sort of things was in this 106?
Oh, I mean, everything. We had, you know, science. We had maths books, which were just, you know, bizarre and wacky numbers. We had views of futurologists. We had the ballistics of warfare, which was all about, essentially, well, ballistics, which was kind of cool, but a bit boysy, I have to say. But I found it quite interesting. I have to say, you know, you start off with an arrow. You know, where does the energy come to fire an arrow? How can you improve upon the shape of a bow? You know, all this sort of stuff. And then got on to ballistics and that kind of stuff. And how you can shell Paris from the Lyon corner over 80 miles away. You know, so there was a lot of very, very different stuff. There was a lot of stuff which was sort of published PhD thesis. So, yeah, a lot of stuff.
Very cool. And we'll let you get to the drinks and nibbles. So, Jasper Ford, thank you very much.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you.
You can follow links on the Pod Delusion website to find more about the Winton Prize. And if you think you've read or even written a prize-winning science book, you can find out how to nominate a book for next year's prize. This has been Liz Luttendorf for the Pod Delusion.
Now, could there be a more perfect setting for a horror film than the Large Hadron Collider? I'm not talking about characters getting stuck in a room full of documents written in Comic Sans, but, you know, because it's full of dark tunnels and scary science machines and all that sort of thing. So I guess this is why some physics PhD students from Manchester who are working on the LHC decided to make a zombie film there, called Decay, which premiered last night. It's going to be made available for public viewing soon, and there's already a cracking trailer online. So earlier this week, I caught up with the director Luke Thompson, assistant director Clara Nellist, and producer Michael Mazur to find out more. I started by asking, what inspired them to make the film?
It was sort of me and Clara at the same time with another guy called Hugo, who is another PhD student. We all, you know, have worked at CERN, including Michael and most of the rest of the people on the film. So basically, Clara had sort of, you know, explored CERN, and it's this sort of cool place with all sorts of different buildings. Like, there's really new buildings and really old buildings, and it's kind of, you know, it's kind of creepy at night and all that sort of stuff. And Hugo and I had been exploring, like, the maintenance tunnels underneath the buildings, and they're all creepy and dark and lonely and wet and all sorts of things. So we thought that was a really cool place to film a horror film. And Clara independently had been sort of thinking the same sort of thing. So we thought, well, why not actually make a zombie film?
Excellent. And as you say, you're not all filmmakers by trade, but you're actually physicists. So just to give our audience flavour, Wayne, what actually is your day jobs?
I'll start. So I'm an accelerator physicist. I work on the accelerators themselves. So for instance, I'm working on the Large Hadron Collider, designing part of an upgrade for it. Actually, two separate projects involving the Large Hadron Collider. Clara?
So I work on the detectors, and I'm working on an upgrade for the middle of Atlas, so the very center of the Atlas detector.
And I was a particle physicist working on the Atlas experiment, doing data analysis for Higgs searches and supersymmetry analysis.
These all sound like complicated things, and we sort of get the impression from the outside that, you know, everyone's very busy there because you've got this gigantic new toy to play with. I mean, how much time did it take to make the film, and how did you find the time to do it?
I have played around with estimates that I think I've spent about 2,000 hours on this total. I think that's more than anybody else, but, you know, it's then sort of a grading down to Michael might have spent 1,000 hours or something. It's a big mishmash.
The whole project's taken about 2 years because we've had to do it in our spare time. So it's been very, you know, late nights on the evening and very late nights at weekends.
So I guess the obvious question to ask is, would you be able to give us a taste of the plot? Judging by the trailer, we know that it's set at CERN and we know zombies appear, but can you tell us a bit more than that?
Well, I think, you know, we obviously don't want to spoil anything. We've got a group of students, and something the previous night has happened to the Large Hadron Collider. Something's caused it to have an accident. And the people at CERN send down a maintenance team to work out what's going on. And while that maintenance team are down in the tunnels, our protagonists, our group of students, are in the control room just monitoring the dials and making sure that nothing goes wrong while they're down there. Of course, something does go wrong. So the maintenance team are irradiated. The students have to sort of escape from the control room, can't get back to the surface. They have to go down and turn the LHC off and navigate their way through the tunnels to try and find the way out. And of course, it turns out that the maintenance team aren't actually dead, well, not all the way anyway. Beyond that, you know, we kind of play with all the zombie film tropes and, with a splash of sort of satirical bad science thrown in.
You say at the very start of the trailer that the film isn't authorized by CERN. I mean, were you guys allowed to just run around the tunnels, or was it all? Would you have to be sneaky about it?
That's a good question.
You might want to edit out our first responses to this, but
we do have access to the tunnels. I mean, they're not the main LHC tunnels that are shown in the film. These are the maintenance tunnels, so it's not restricted access.
Anything that's kind of important or critical or dangerous or anything like that is restricted access. So the Large Hadron Collider tunnel itself, we couldn't go in that or anything. All the areas that we filmed in are sort of, if you're at CERN, you can get into the, it's just, you know, you go down a set of stairs and suddenly you're in these tunnels. So we weren't in any dangerous areas or areas where we could have damaged equipment or anything like that.
I love the bit in the trailer where you've got the big, like, the gigantic switches to switch it off. I take it they weren't the real off switches.
That was just a bit of Hollywood magic right there.
So have anyone from CERN said anything? Have any higher-ups sort of reacted to the film since it's appeared on the internet and done the rounds?
So part of the reason for that disclaimer at the beginning of the film is because, having made, you know, most of the film, we sort of went to the higher-ups at CERN and said, you know, are you cool with this? Is this okay? And they were like, yeah, pretty much, as long as you sort of make it clear that it's not an official CERN thing, because, you know, they've got a good sense of humor about it, which is great. Sort of puts things in a good light like that. But they wanted to be sure that nobody actually thought it was, you know, real, that nobody thought they were, that the Large Hadron Collider is actually going to create zombies somehow.
Yeah, I think they're a little wary of conspiracy theories about the LHC creating dangerous things. So it's just to make sure people know that it's definitely not real.
If the film had been about making a black hole, for instance, do you reckon they'd be a bit more cautious?
Yeah, I don't think they'd have been keen on that.
Thing is, I mean, obviously that satirical element, you know, the idea is, well, what's more ridiculous than the LHC making black holes? The LHC making zombies. So that's kind of the whole, you know, it's making fun of those conspiracy theories and things like that.
So do you actually explain in the film how the LHC creates the zombies? Do you have some pseudoscience? As scientists, have you thought about how that process would work?
Yeah, we've got a great simulation animation that Luke made in the film to explain how the zombies are made.
Which, again, is all pseudoscience.
I've got one controversial question for you, which I think might be quite contentious. Have you gone for fast zombies or slow zombies in the film?
Oh, we had a big debate about this, and I had quite a strong opinion on it. So I prefer slow zombies because that's more classical. But I think Luke's reasoning behind... So we have fast zombies in the film, but the reasoning behind that is because of the restricted space and, you know, the number of extras that we could have. It just made more sense for the plot.
zombies to be a threat, you know, in an enclosed space where we can only have a handful of zombies, then they really had to be fast, because if they were slow and we only had two zombies, then, you know, you could envision any number of ways that the group could escape from that.
I was going to say, production-wise, the trailer looks amazing, and considering, I mean, you've done this on a shoestring budget, haven't you?
If at all. It's just been a huge learning process for all of us, and it was a case of going in feet first and just trying things out and getting them to work and spending our time on it and making it as good as we could do. So it's not a question of budget, really. It's just a question of willingness and the effort that goes into it.
Yeah, and we had a lot of very enthusiastic extras and crew. So they put a lot of time into making the film, which adds to the production value.
Excellent. So we'll put links to find out more about the film on the Pod Delusion website. But how is the film being released, and how will our listeners be able to see it?
Well, the primary way is it's going to be online, and it's going to be under a Creative Commons license. That means you can copy it, you can share it, you can sort of remix it, you can use it in other projects, as long as it's got our names on it as such. And that'll be on the website, and that's going to be on December the 8th.
Brilliant. And we'll put links to all of that on the Pod Delusion website. Have you thought about doing subtitles in Comic Sans at all?
I think we're going to have to now.
Yeah, I'm not going to answer that, because I do have some plans.
Excellent. We'll leave it there. Luke, Michael, Clara, thank you so much. Well, I look forward to seeing the film.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Now, if TV is anything to go by, the American high school experience is a quirky time of your life. You've got the jocks wearing monogram jackets with the school's initials on, bullying the nerds with their thick glasses. There's the cheerleaders, of which membership equals high social status, and that there's lots of slamming people against lockers in ways that help character development. But did you know that in between the house parties where everyone drinks from red cups and teenagers inexplicably being able to afford brand new cars with retractable roofs, there's also a great theological debate? Like much of America, often high schools have their priorities wrong. Rather than fixing the system so that they call maths by its proper name, religion can sometimes be a big deal instead, and it often makes it hard to be an atheist. And that's why this week Salim Fadli has been speaking to a rather prolific blogger who has just published a new book aimed at helping young atheists survive. Here's Sal with more.
Hemant Mehta teaches maths at a Chicago high school. He's best known as the Friendly Atheist. He writes one of the most widely read blogs, which broadly deals with what it's like to be an atheist in a country which is obsessed and dominated by religion. Hemant's new book, The Young Atheist Survival Guide, draws from both his professional and blogging life. I began by asking him whether he had intended this new book to be a sort of guide for high schoolers wishing to come out as irreligious in a potentially hostile school environment.
You know, it's partly a guide, but it's partly a collection of these stories of what high school students in America have to go through, whether it's dealing with their friends or their parents or graduation ceremonies or athletic events. Religion comes into play so much at a public high school. And what I seem to come across when I see these stories and I write about them on my website is students, they sometimes don't know how to navigate these issues. And so what this book does is shares the stories of students who have dealt with these obstacles, or sometimes, you know, they didn't know how to deal with it. And it explains how they can deal with those situations and how they can get the help that they need. And hopefully, you know, if they read the story, they realize, oh, man, I'm not the only atheist at my school.
So what kinds of challenges face kids coming out as non-religious in American high schools?
I realize that even in liberal areas like the one I live in, we're still talking about a population that is mostly Christian. Then you move to the South, the Bible Belt area, Southern America, it's overwhelmingly Christian. And so to be the one person at your school who doesn't believe in God, that's not only a scary thing to say, it's a potentially dangerous thing to say, because to a lot of Christians, you saying you're an atheist is like telling them, I'm an immoral person, I am a bad influence on other students. You're basically throwing away any social capital you have. And that's one reason so many students don't do it.
It's not just pressure from other kids, is it, though? Sometimes teachers and staff, even in secular public schools,
feel that it's their role to evangelize Christianity.
There are teachers who will tell kids, you know, I would keep that information to yourself if you say you don't believe in God. Or teachers who actively proselytize in the classroom. There was a teacher in California not too long ago who had big banners in his classroom talking about how this was a Christian country and how God blessed America. And he was a math teacher. He wasn't even like a theology teacher or anything else like that. And usually, you know, the atheists, if they want to file a lawsuit against the school, they may very well win the lawsuit. But sometimes you got to go public if you're the plaintiff in the case. And a lot of people don't want to go public with their atheism. And you can't really remain anonymous in some of these stories. So, you know, your options are stay silent and don't raise a ruckus and fit in, or be who you really are and be honest about it and then get shunned by everybody.
You're a high school math teacher.
Yeah.
When religious matters come up in your own class, I know that's not obviously your choosing. How do you deal with that?
You know, I'm honest about the fact that I don't believe in God. I do have a website. There's no reason to lie about it. I'm here to teach math. I'm not here to discuss my beliefs with anybody. And if they really want to have those conversations, it's something that needs to take place outside of class. And honestly, I have never even done that before. It's never happened. So the funny thing is, even as the website has grown more popular over the past few years, I've probably gotten fewer questions about my atheism recently. Because I think the kids know, oh, that's just not something you talk about with your teachers.
Speaking of appropriate venues to discuss this sort of thing, you've been one of the most vocal proponents of forming secular student alliances within schools and colleges. Is this one of the things that teachers and parents can help kids do?
Yes, it is so important for teachers to be willing to sponsor some of these groups. In America, if you want to start a group, an after-school club at a high school, the students have to take the initiative. They need to find officers. They need to find a faculty sponsor. Sometimes they want to start a group, but they don't have any teachers they feel comfortable talking to. Or sometimes they'll find a faculty member who's willing to be their sponsor and sign all the paperwork and everything. But that faculty sponsor gets told by the principal that it would be a bad career move for them to lead an atheist organization. Sometimes administrators give students the runaround so that those groups don't start because they know they can't legally put a stop to it, but they'll do whatever they can to find a way around that. But if there are students willing to start a group, who want to start a group, what they need are faculty members willing to stand up for them, willing to sign the papers necessary, willing to stand up against parents and administrators who might oppose it, and who are willing to moderate those discussions, because those are not easy conversations to have. And sometimes students aren't the best equipped to ask the right questions, to know what there is to talk about.
You're not just any old math teacher. The world knows you as the friendly atheist, and that's a persona that you've developed, a distinctly different voice to some of the so-called new atheists who are famous for their confrontational rhetoric. You seem to have established yourself as a spokesperson for non-religious people amongst the Christian right. Was that ever your intent?
When I first started writing about this stuff and talking about religion openly in a public forum, I wasn't Christian to begin with. I was raised in a Jain family, an Indian background, an Indian religion. And so I don't have a lot of the baggage, you know, leaving Christianity because I never left it. You know, now I think it's fair to say that I've come to terms with how problematic religion can be. And I'm much more vocal about what my problems are with religion than they used to be. But I think I feel like I'm someone who doesn't take cheap shots against everyone I disagree with on the atheist side. I think a lot of atheists online and in person too, anyone who does believe in God, they go after them. And I understand why they do it. I mean, those people believe in things that are untrue, and atheists and the new atheists that you mentioned, they're all about the truth, and there's nothing wrong with that. I just don't think I can reach everybody, so I put my focus on the people I need to focus on. And so it's not that I think they're right. It's not that I think we shouldn't criticize them where it's due, but I put my focus elsewhere.
If you'd like to read Hemant's blog, buy one of his books, such as The Young Atheist's Survival Guide, you can find a link to his blog, The Friendly Atheist, in our show notes. This is Salim Fadli for The Pod Delusion.
Now, one of the main evil things that the current government is doing is changing the benefit system so that even if you're on your last legs, you might still be declared fit for work because, hey, those last legs are still legs, so walk it off. As you might imagine, this has resulted in quite a lot of protests. And our next contributor, Stephen Sumpter, is one of the most vocal online critics of the reforms. And this week he brings us a radical proposal for how he thinks things should be done instead. He reckons that given changes in technology and lifestyles and stuff, shouldn't we rethink our notions of work? Or is this idea just one pogrom away from collectivising the farms, hanging the aristocracy from the lampposts, and having an October revolution in November? I'm kind of assuming we'll get a response to this piece on next week's show. So to explain more, here's Stephen.
I want to propose something controversial. I want every citizen to be paid a salary out of taxation, whether they work or not. It's not my idea, or even a new idea, but with lots of people calling for welfare reform, and with the Welfare Reform Act 2012 already having disastrous consequences, I think its time has come. Lots of jobs are done by people who aren't paid to do them. People look after their relatives, cook for neighbours, run clubs for kids, or just look after the garden for their block. Lots of the people aren't employed at all, never mind paid to do what they do. They're often on job seekers' allowance or sickness benefits, but they're doing what they can to help the people around them. Lots more jobs are done part-time for low wages by people who aren't the main wage earner, people like cleaners, carers, and private tutors. Single parents are often expected to find a job and pay someone else to look after their children. Then there are people with hobbies that not only make them happy, but also contribute to society, or have uses far beyond just their hobby. Writers, inventors, scientists, musicians, artists, they make things of great worth to everyone. When they work all hours of the day in a paid job, these things are neglected, but when they work less or not at all, they are free to pursue their own interests. My point is that there is worth in a vast number of things that are not part of work, and yet these tasks are not valued by people, and the government does not see any worth outside of a paid job. Attitudes to welfare benefits are hardening. Press and government have divided people into deserving and undeserving poor. Politicians say that we should have more conditionality, that people who haven't spent enough time in work can't claim the same benefits that those who have worked for years can. Lots of people think that people on benefits shouldn't have so-called luxuries like Sky TV or broadband. They resent these things being paid for by benefits out of taxes. Government ministers have even raised the idea of paying benefits through payment cards that can't be used to purchase alcohol or tobacco. I think when there are so few available jobs and so many people who can't find the job or can't work anyway, it's vindictive to punish them like this. The question I want to ask, though, is why do we think everyone has to work in the first place? I believe the answer is that they don't. In our society, we've driven down cost of production through two things: exploitation of cheap overseas labour and automation. I'll come back to the first of these later, but what of the second? Machinery has massively reduced the need for manpower. We could go even further towards eliminating people from production, but historically it's been opposed by unions because it puts people out of work. I think the time has come to say, let's put people out of work, automate everything that can be automated. The leftover jobs that can't be done by machines should be divided up between everyone who wants to work, reducing the hours of all the jobs until those who want to work have the working hours that they want. Of course, if we did that, it would leave loads of people without an income. They'd have to depend on job seekers' allowance while looking for jobs that just don't exist. We can't punish them for failing to find jobs that aren't there, although the current system does just that. I say that we should change the way that society thinks about people who don't work. We have to stop resenting them, stop begrudging them any small luxuries that they have, and instead pay them a decent income that allows a decent life. But that would be unfair, you say. Why should they get something I don't? Well, there's a solution to that. Pay a salary to everyone, working or not, deserving or not. This concept is known as universal basic income, among other names, and here's how it would work. Every adult citizen would have a salary paid to them by the government, tax-free, enough to cover basic living costs. It would be set at around the level that people get in benefits at the moment, taking into account job seekers' allowance, housing benefit, and a few other things. To pay for it, we would scrap pensions, job seekers' allowance, sickness benefits, and most other benefits, and we would scrap the personal allowance for taxes. Instead, we would tax everyone as soon as they start earning. The level of income tax would have to be raised slightly to cover the cost of paying this income to everyone, but since they would get and keep universal basic income, it would balance out for those on lower incomes. Sick and disabled people have additional expenses and a higher cost of living caused by needing to adapt things around them and inability to access some services, so they would still receive disability living allowance to provide for that, and personal care would still be funded by government too. There would be lots of benefits to introducing universal basic income. There would be no reason to means test people anymore, and means testing is expensive. There would be no reason to track people's efforts to look for work, and there would be no reason to punish anyone for not working, eliminating a huge bureaucracy required to do those things. There would be no stress and fear of losing benefits imposed on people for one reason or another cannot work, no work capability assessment, which would lead to improvements in health and quality of life for those subject to it at the moment. Of course, people will object to those choosing not to work, which is why we have to approach the idea with less judgment. Although benefit fraud is tiny, and the number of people who would choose not to work is low, people like that do exist. There are people who don't want to work, and there are people who are just plain unemployable. Under the current and proposed systems, they would be punished for not finding work, and ultimately end up homeless or dependent on family or charity, if anyone at all. I don't think this is the action of a humane society. Would it not be better to let these people stay out of the workplace, avoid employing people who don't want to be there or wouldn't do a good job? People who haven't been unemployed or too sick to work may think that it's a life of luxury, but having nothing to do is extremely boring, and not having enough money for the nice things in life just plain sucks. In the end, most people will find something meaningful and useful to do, or they will decide that they do want to work and then find a job and pay taxes. There are many people that want to work part-time, and lots of jobs that only require part-time. Universal basic income would let people do that, where the new universal credit would make it impossible. We must consider the exploitation of cheap overseas labour that I mentioned earlier. The ideal for me would be to see universal basic income implemented worldwide, but I know that's a pipe dream. I think, though, that by allowing people here to have enough money not to worry, that they can make more ethical choices in what they buy, and that many small, low-paid jobs would become less undesirable to people here, especially if they're only part-time. Universal basic income would have to be accompanied by rent caps to prevent private landlords from inflating rents and taking advantage of more available income. I'm sure that there will be other knock-on effects that we must consider. But we must consider the idea. The whole idea of universal basic income requires a huge shift in the way that our society thinks, but the current system is seen as unfair by those in work and demeaning by those not in work. There are many, many benefits of universal basic income. We can save money on means testing and administration. We can allow people to work part-time or full-time or not at all. We can allow people to pursue their hobbies and their interests, and we might see innovations and inventions that benefit all of us. We would get new books, music and art. We would let people help others in their community and care for those around them. And we would shift the balance of power from employers to employees and provide job security where there is none at the moment. Let's think about this idea. This is Stephen Sumpter for The Pod Delusion.
Now, if you're listening to this programme, then chances are that you quite enjoy listening to sciencey stuff on the radio, which is why it was bewildering this week to see that the BBC have axed the science programme The Naked Scientists from BBC Cambridgeshire. So to explain how silly this is, and in lieu of having a show of her own to tell people, here's presenter Kat Arney explaining why this was a rather silly idea.
Do you love science? Of course you do. And so do the Naked Scientists. We're a group of researchers and medics who've produced and presented a weekly BBC radio show on Sunday nights for the best part of a decade, covering science, medicine, technology and all that kind of stuff. I was just a radio nipper when I started co-presenting the show back then, and my voice sounded all like this. You may have only heard us on radio if you're in the eastern counties of England. That's Norfolk, Essex, Cambridgeshire and the like. But our podcasts have been downloaded by millions of people around the world, bringing great science radio to the ears of local and international listeners. And all of this from a little BBC radio studio in Cambridge. Now, in case you haven't listened to The Naked Scientists, we aim to make science fun and understandable. We present the latest discoveries. We speak to amazing researchers in academia and industry from East Anglia, the rest of the UK and around the world. We have phone-ins where people can ask direct questions. We have kitchen science where you can join in with experiments at home. And it's all with a hefty dose of fun. And that's kind of the good, funny kind, not the zany, wacky kind. It's exactly what the BBC should be doing. It's educational, informative and entertaining. And it's now being axed. Yes, as of January 2013, The Naked Scientists will no longer be gracing the BBC airwaves across the eastern counties. Now, let's be clear, this isn't a financial decision. The Naked Scientists is funded by grants. We cost the BBC £40 a show. To put it in perspective, George Entwistle's recent Director General payoff would have paid for 11,000 Naked Scientist shows. I only get paid £50 a show, which also covers the hours of prep that each show takes. No, the BBC have made this decision on so-called editorial grounds for two reasons. Firstly, we're too specialist. Unlike their specialist gardening, religious, country music, or all the other specialist shows they have. No, science, technology and medicine are somehow too niche for local radio to cope with, despite it touching all our lives and being a rapidly growing area of popular culture. Oh, hi, Brian Cox. Yet the BBC have also said the show isn't local enough, despite being helmed by a local doctor, that's Chris Smith, and broadcast from what I certainly consider to be one of the greatest scientific hubs in the world, Cambridge. Yeah, you want to fight about it? We feature a whole host of local researchers, not just from Cambridge, but from the whole region. And how did the BBC get the idea that only local science is for local people? Does Suffolk not have chlorophyll? Do the good citizens of Norwich not get cancer? Do satellites give Ipswich the swerve when they go overhead? Well, can't blame them, really. But the Naked Scientists should be a jewel in the local radio crown. Instead, they're axing it to give more time to those vital issues of generic music and tedious chit-chat. And as a local musician as well, whose band is based in Cambridge, I find this a double slap in the face, because it's not like they're pledging to only play local music from now on. It seems like only local science is local enough for local people, but music from across the world is fine. And in my day job for Cancer Research UK, I often go on local radio to talk about national or even global cancer news stories. So I know that local audiences are interested in national and international science. Feel outraged yet? Well, you should be. But you can help to save the Naked Scientists. We need to get loads and loads of people to tell the BBC that local radio listeners deserve better, and that perhaps the Naked Scientists should have an even wider audience. How about that shiny new BBC England station they're starting up next year that's going to replace some of their oh-so-precious local programming with national programmes anyway? Here are the people to email with your thoughts, so go and get a pen. I'll wait. There's Alison Hastings at the BBC Trust. She deals with England and local radio. Her email address is alison.hastings@bbc.co.uk. David Holdsworth is the controller for BBC England. He's david.holdsworth, H-O-L-D-S-W-O-R-T-H, at bbc.co.uk. And Mick Rawsthorne is the regional controller for the Eastern Counties, who are axing us. That's mick.rawsthorne, R-A-W-S-T-H-O-R-N-E, at bbc.co.uk. All these email addresses and more information are on the Naked Scientists Facebook page. That's facebook.com/thenakedscientists. Thanks for listening and thank you for your support. If you care about helping local people everywhere to discover more about science, medicine and technology, then please help to save the Naked Scientists.
Finally this week, you may have seen the film Argo, which was released into cinemas recently. It's gripping and tense. It was almost the perfect film adaptation of the novel it was based on, the Argos catalogue. Which is why this week, as it's topical, we asked Sean Ellis if he could try and figure out exactly how Argos works.
It's Christmas! Well, nearly. Yes, in the run-up to Christmas, it's time to think about what the true meaning of Christmas really is. Presents. I want to take you all present shopping. Now, if you want a nice cheap present for someone, where's your first port of call? Argos, obviously. Argos are everywhere. In every road, on every street corner, in every city shopping precinct, Argos after Argos. Pretty much every town in the UK seems to have a branch. Yet few people stop to think about them in any detail, and the details really don't stand up to examination. Every Argos is a small shop, either sandwiched between two other small retail outlets in the high street, or behind 12 feet of glass shopfront in a mall. And yet, they offer a variety of goods unmatched by most large department stores. They make available every item in the laminated Book of Dreams, laminated, as fans of Bill Bailey will know, to protect it from the tears of joy wept by those who peruse the cornucopia of delights offered up on its hallowed pages. So, Debenhams? Huge multi-floor edifice, 5 types of bed, some cardigans, and a table full of scented candles. Argos? Tiny little shop, 15,000 different products. This doesn't stack up. This needs investigation. One possible mitigating factor is that they have no display space. No aisles, and no sales force needing restrooms and facilities, but this accounts for maybe 25% of the total space in a typical store. 25% less than your average John Lewis doesn't get you anywhere near as small as a city centre Argos. This is clearly not the real solution to the problem. Argos cannot possibly be as small as it is. The truth must be covered up. Why? The reason for the total suppression of the real nature of Argos must be that the truth, if it comes out, would revolutionise the entire retail sector and possibly society at large. The number of people involved would include the staff of each outlet, builders, delivery personnel, warehousemen and so forth. Some people might say that such a large number of people could never be kept silent for so long, but their fearful silence merely confirms the utter ruthlessness of the regime under which they labour, if labour is the right word for it. The solution to this conundrum, when it's revealed, is quite simple, and explains all the disparate facets of both Argos and the frightening effectiveness of the suppression of the truth. Are you ready? Nanotechnology. No, think about it. General-purpose nanotech assemblers have been a long-sought-after breakthrough in material science for decades. Argos got there first and kept the secret for themselves. When you're in an Argos, you never see beyond the mysterious conveyor belt from which all goods appear. This is deliberate, as the conveyor is actually the output from a smart matter compiler, able to construct any item in the catalogue, atom by atom, from a selection of simple liquid feedstocks. Matter compilers are quite fast, but they still need finite time to work, which explains why you always have to wait several minutes for your purchases, even if the branch is basically deserted. They have to work in a vacuum, and the decompression phase cools the item down, which is why they're often cooler than ambient temperature when delivered. The feedstock is basically liquid organic chemicals, which can be kept in tanks. Although large, they're much denser than any warehouse contents, allowing the branches to have a very small behind-the-scenes area. Small secondary tanks are used for specialised additives, such as chromium bling or lithium for batteries. Despite this flexibility, there is, at present, a relatively small number of materials which can be synthesised, which explains why most items in the catalogue appear to be made from the same kind of plastic. As for the question of leaks, nanotechnology also offers the ability for real mind control. The control they have over their stuff is chilling. You can see it in the dead-eyed stare of the work experience girl on the till, in the incredulous expression of the local branch manager when you ask to see his matter compiler, and the robotic gait of the security guard as he escorts you to the door. And so, I rest my case. I appeal to the Argos High Council to release the secret of nanotechnology for the benefit of all mankind, not just the manufacturer of Lego Mindstorms kit at below half the recommended retail price. And if you think this is only a conspiracy theory, think on this. It has just as much evidence as the suppression of cold fusion, zero-point energy, and the existence of our evil lizard overlords. And we all know how reliable those are, don't we? This is Sean Ellis, about to be kidnapped to keep me quiet for the Pod Delusion.
And that's just about it for this week's show. Before we go, some good news. Richard O'Dwyer isn't being extradited, as we covered a few weeks back with his mother on the show. And also, do check out our website at poddelusion.co.uk, where you can listen to over 3 years' worth of archives, as well as loads more on the Poddelusion Extra feed. Also on our website, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or even listen to the show on YouTube, though I'm uploading the show slower to YouTube, as it's very hard work. If you have enjoyed the Poddelusion, please do support what we do. You can subscribe and donate £5 or £10 a month, and help us pay all of the server bills and other costs associated with the podcast. You can also make a one-off donation. You can find links to do all that at poddelusion.co.uk. The Pod Delusion this week was brought to you by Liz Luckendorf, Salim Fadley, Stephen Sumter, Kat Arney, Sean Ellis, and me, James O'Malley, with additional editing by Liz Luckendorf. The sketch in a moment is by David Lovesey and Brian Too. Pod Delusion is a partner of the British Humanist Association. Thanks for listening.
Stop moping, Michael. Come to bed.
I can't, Ingrid. Since Angela Merkel's government decided to vote on recriminalizing bestiality, I just can't sleep.
Michael, you have a beautiful wife here and ready for you. You don't need to go off every night having sexual relations with the animal kingdom.
It's not that simple, Ingrid. The fur, the sweat.
I can shower. I can shave.
I don't mean you. The gentle bellow. Once you've had yak, one never goes back.
Oh, come to bed. I can make you forget all of that.
Will you wear the horns?
You know I won't. Last time they scraped all the varnish off the headboard.
And what about the...
I won't wear the hooves either. Why won't you make those doe eyes at me anymore like you used to?
Because you're not a doe, my dear. A female, dear.
I just think it's time you try to improve our love life.
I do. Just the other day we went to that swingers party, and we all put our keys into the goldfish bowl and...
Oh, but Michael, you spent the night with the goldfish.
Yeah, how could I not? She was so coy.
Concentrate on me, Michael, not the misguided, malodorous menagerie you hanker for.
And what about you? Talk about the Koptov calling the Kessel Schwarz. You spend all your evenings watching that porn on the television.
What? Springwatch?
It's disgusting. Some of those models are barely cubs. I'm not a pervert.
Oh, come to bed. We can... Oh, Michael, there's a big spider on the pillow.
I suppose you want me to sweep it out of the window?
Well, you could. Or perhaps we could make it a threesome.
Oh, arachnotastic.